It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've come a long way from Dick and Jane and how we teach reading in schools. This hour, reading readiness, reading education, what we know about how children learn to read, and techniques designed to help children with learning challenges. But first, the state of Iowa passed a new law in 2012 that requires Iowa third graders to be proficient at reading to advance. Starting in the summer of 2017, third graders who are not proficient in reading will be required to attend a summer program or repeat the third grade. This summer, a pilot program will be launched to help at least 1,800 students across 40 school districts. That program is still in the planning stages. And with me now to help us understand the new program and implementation of the law is Ryan Weiss, director of the Iowa Department of Education. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, the passage of this law changed requirements for how teachers assess the reading levels of their students. How are we assessing reading proficiency in Iowa now?
So now in Iowa, we're taking a look at students when they're in kindergarten through the third grade to really ensure that we have a system in place that looks at, are they on track to be proficient readers by the end of third grade? So we're looking at their reading proficiency in the fall, winter, and spring to see how they're doing. And then we're also looking at, for those students that are falling behind and struggling, monitoring their progress on a regular basis in between those three intervals during the year.
Now, in a lot of coverage of this new law and in sources cited when the law was being passed, a lot of the statistics that were being used were from the Iowa assessments, which are given to children in third grade and the rest of elementary or, you know, upper elementary school every year in the state of Iowa. But we are not basing reading proficiency on those Iowa assessments anymore. What assessment tools are we using for all of those check-ins?
So proficiency, you're correct, isn't based on one test or one tool alone. So the summative assessment at the end of the year, while it's an important indicator of a student's reading proficiency and reading level, we're looking at during the year an ongoing system that gauges a student's proficiency. So are they reading fluently throughout these three checkpoints? And we have a system called the FAST system that looks at, again, a student's proficiency along the way to that end-of-year test.
When the statistics are cited from the Iowa assessments, the Iowa Department of Education found that 8,000 public school third graders, nearly one in four, were not reading proficiently in 2014 or 2015. According to the new assessment tools, the FAST system, what levels are we seeing? How many students could this new law affect?
So you're right. The data on reading proficiency based on the Iowa assessments has been right about 75% of Iowa third graders are reading proficiently at the end of the third grade. And that's been stagnant for across the past decade. When we look at the early warning system that's screening students at multiple times throughout the year, that number can potentially be even higher than that. And the reason is throughout that screening process, we actually look at even a higher bar, because I think as you try and see where are students in their proficiency, at that stage, it's best to err on an over-identification side so that we can catch students who may have reading challenges before they become problems and before they're, you know, not proficient at the end of third grade.
Now, I've been going to parent-teacher conferences for the last couple of years and looking at the results of the new screening tools because my son is now in second grade. And I wonder, you know, teachers are doing a lot of different assessments. They are implementing a new program. Do you feel confident that these systems are being implemented correctly? There's a learning curve here for teachers.
There's absolutely a learning curve, and I'm in the same boat as you are. So I'm also a parent. I have a first-grade son and a fourth-grade son in Des Moines. Moines Public Schools, and conferences were last night. And so it was fascinating. So my first grade son's teacher showed me the results of the FAST test and how my son was doing in comparison throughout the grade. And being in the position I am, in addition to being a parent, I had to stop and say, okay, that's great how my kid is doing. Now tell me more about FAST and how is it going for you as a teacher and how are you working with your students? And so my son's teacher said she felt like it was going well. She appreciated the data and at the same time, a new process that takes a lot of work.
The stakes are pretty high for the kids who are being assessed. Do you feel confident that the system is going to work?
I think we're putting in place the foundational components to ensure kids are reading proficiently by the end of third grade. And I am confident that as we continue to move forward with the emphasis we've put on this early warning system, with our effort to develop a high-quality intensive summer reading program and our partnership with the University of Iowa to develop the Iowa Reading Research Center, which will help not only develop the summer program but develop and share best practices for reading instruction, I am confident that we'll get a system in place that really does ensure kids have the support they need to read proficiently.
Now, I know that the pilot summer program is being launched this summer, and I know it's still in development, although summer is coming fast.
It is.
Can you tell me what a summer program will look like once it's implemented?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, that is being developed right now, and rules were recently passed that laid out some broad guidelines of what a summer program should look like, and including the number of hours, the percentage of attendance that students need to be there to consider to have successfully completed the program. And so all of that is coming together right now. There will be some flexibility for local schools and districts to determine the structure. Of what does a day look like? What does a week look like? How long does it go throughout the course of the summer? All of those things are coming together, along with the actual curricular materials that will be used. I know the summer reading pilot will look at three different models and really test out a few different options. This is really designed to give some guidance and to help districts see now before we get into 2017, what are some best practices here? And what can we learn from these summer pilots that will really influence how these summer programs are developed moving forward? And again, ensure that they help catch kids up who may have fallen behind.
Now, if the numbers tend to hold and approximately 25% of students in third grade are going to need to go to these summer programs, and of course in some districts that will be much higher, in other districts that'll be lower, but that's a lot of students and that's a lot of teacher time. Who pays for these programs?
You're right. This is a time-intensive endeavor, and we hope that, over the course of the next year and a half, we continue to support reading, catch kids up, and that those numbers of students who may have summer school as an option continues to decrease. We also know there's a series of exemptions for why students might not be required to participate in summer reading. For example, students who are English language learners who have received less than 2 years of instruction here would not be required to participate in summer school to avoid retention. So I think there are a number of factors that will continue to hopefully decrease the number as we get closer to the summer of 2017. But costs are a real component of that. And I think that's a topic that's under consideration in the legislature right now. The governor has expressed his commitment to ensure that in the summer of 2017, there is funding in place, because we know this is an additional expense for districts that they will need to figure out things like transportation, curricular materials, staffing, all of those things that contribute to the cost of running a really effective, high-quality summer program.
Now, the wording of the rule is very important here, that third graders who are not proficient in reading will be required to attend a summer program or repeat the third grade. So if these students attend the summer program and are not proficient readers at the end of that program, what does that mean?
they would still move on to the fourth grade. So the emphasis here is on participating in the program. Students need to attend, I think the rules say, at least 85% or more of the summer program, and that constitutes successful completion. So the emphasis there on the summer piece is really on full participation and having that opportunity to take another step toward reading proficiently.
Now, I know most teachers, most school administrators would say holding a child back is an act of last resort, because retention of a student sometimes can have short-term benefits but long-term negative impact on students in many different ways. Why is retention, why is holding students back an important component of this plan?
So retention is probably one of the most controversial education interventions that exists right now. And certainly people look at, you know, the challenges, the, both the benefits and challenges when that policy is in place. You know, for us, and I think when this was instituted in law back in 2012, you know, retention sends an important signal that this is a serious issue. And so we want to mobilize the education system so that the supports, the early identification, the interventions are in place so that it doesn't get to that point.
Because so it sounds like you're hoping that it's just a threat.
Well, I wouldn't say a threat, but at the same time, I think, you know, we hope that the system comes together and puts things in place that does avoid it, because retention is not an absolute in the law. There are other ways for students to progress, and frankly, whether you retain a student or the student is, you know, passed on without being proficient, the results for those kids are not great either direction. And so we want to ensure the supports are in place so that kids have those foundational skills so that they're set up when they move into upper elementary, middle school, high school, and beyond. They can continue to take more difficult coursework and be prepared for life beyond school.
Ryan, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity. It was a pleasure.
Ryan Weiss is the director of the Iowa Department of Education. Again, starting in the summer of 2017, third graders who are not proficient in reading will be required to attend a summer program or repeat the third grade in the state of Iowa. We'll continue our conversation about reading in a moment. We're going to talk about reading readiness, reading education, and what we know about how children learn to read. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about reading education in Iowa. And as you know, starting next summer, state law will require that third graders who are not proficient in reading attend a summer program or repeat the third grade. This is a big deal in school districts all over Iowa, but for some, it's an even bigger deal. For example, in Davenport, according to the new standards, 51.5% of third grade students are not proficient at reading. Davenport Superintendent Arthur Tate is here with us now. Hello, Arthur.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to do it.
Now, I just mentioned that statistic. According to data obtained from the Iowa Department of Education in the fall of 2015, 675 students were determined to be at risk of substantially deficient reading. That's 51.5%. How concerned are you by these numbers in Davenport?
We've always been concerned. I mean, reading has been our focus for years on end, so this is certainly reflective of things we've been working on for years.
How realistic do you feel that the numbers are?
Well, we're using the FAST test, so we're certainly compared to other districts, so I have to, you know, believe that the test is a fairly accurate reflection of where our students are, so I certainly don't go and question that.
All right. And the FAST tests have been around now for a couple of years. We were just talking about them a moment ago. From the teachers in your district who've been using these tests, we talked about the fact that there is a learning curve to giving them, and they're very time-consuming for the teachers. What kind of feedback are you getting from teachers about this assessment tool?
Well, we had for about 3 years what's called a Dibbles test. It was much like the FAST in that you had to do benchmarking three times a year. So our teachers were used to doing benchmarking. The difference is with the FAST, you now have a combination of one-to-one with the student, but also there's computer work. So that's certainly been different, and we've had to adjust in the buildings themselves because every student We're doing the K through three. Every student has to actually go and take the test on the computer. So we've arranged, we actually have a SWAT team that goes into schools and does the FAST for us, so the teachers won't be taken away from their main duties. But part of the issue is that we also have to do the weekly monitoring for those students who are deficient. And the weekly monitoring is done by the teacher, and that takes the teacher away from class. And I go out into schools and classes a lot, and I go in and actually see a teacher at his or her desk. They're doing the FAST monitoring, and meanwhile, the other students are doing work by themselves. And that's okay, because it certainly can be guided in little stations. But again, it is more difficult, it is different, and it does take a lot of teacher time.
Why do you feel the numbers are so high in Davenport? And you mentioned this is something you've been struggling with for a long time. What are the factors that combine to make this such a challenge for so many of your students?
Well, and I want to make sure that everyone understands what I'm going to talk about now are challenges and opportunities and not excuses. We have 67% free and reduced lunch, and that's certainly a reflection of poverty. And when we start to look at issues that we need to overcome in order to make sure that everyone has a level playing field for education, poverty is the main issue. And so, again, one of our board's two priorities is to reduce the impact of poverty on education, and reading is certainly a reflection of that.
How are you preparing to meet the requirements of the new mandate?
Well, we're not doing anything different than we have done before, because, as I said, reading has been a concern, and we have core reading that we have, that's our main program in the curriculum. But then we have alternate cores, which many of our schools are using, and they're programs that have been focused on that particular school or that particular faculty. And we have interventions. Each of my schools has a full-time interventionist who deals with the students, which we call are on a tier three. They're the most difficult, or having the most difficult issues with reading. Our schools either have a half-time coach or a full-time coach for reading. And we just keep at the professional development over and over and over. We have, for 3 years now in our district, trained our teachers in what's called letters. It's literature essentials for teachers of reading and spelling. And that's a 16-day course, which every one of our elementary student teachers had, as well as our special education teachers. We have something called the 95% group. It's a special intervention and diagnostic tool that we use. So we're just trying every single thing that we can see in the reading science and the research, which has been helpful for students to learn to read.
Can you give me an idea of how successful these interventions have been? I was focusing on the numbers from your third graders, but as the children get older, are we seeing proficiency reading levels rise in the Davenport schools?
We've seen some great successes in the schools that implement the things I just talked about with fidelity. So we know they are working, and the incremental increases are very, very slow. Sometimes you wish, gosh, can't we get 10 or 15% increase? And again, I have some schools that are doing that. But as a district, it is a slow, slow process. And people often ask me, well, how long does it take to turn around a system when you're really working on something like reading? And you're talking 3, 4, and 5 years. So, again, I see the incremental change. We know we're on the right path, or we wouldn't keep doing these things.
Now, many districts around the state already offer a summer school option for students who are behind in school. Is that something Davenport already does?
Yep, we've done that. Last year, for example, we had about 600 kids. We do it K through third grade, and it's something we've done summer after summer.
So with the new mandate, how will that change your program in Davenport, do you think?
Well, the mandate is about third grade, so we will still probably give summer school for K-1 and 2, but our major concentration obviously is going to have to be on the third grade students who are substantially deficient.
You mentioned earlier that you have 67% free and reduced lunch in your district.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with transportation for these students during the summer, for summer school? Is that something you provide?
Yes, we provide the transportation. That's a critical key. I mean, we try to locate the programs in the communities and the neighborhoods where it's needed the most, but we do provide transportation.
All right. And I'm guessing that would be a critical key as well with the new mandate, because a lot of these families just can't transport their students.
Absolutely. You've got to do that. We find, not just for reading, but for any of the issues which we have, parent participation or closing the achievement gap, that it comes down to transportation much of the time. They just aren't able to get to places where they need to be.
With the new law, it doesn't just require that students go to summer school. It says that if they don't go to summer school and participate in this summer program, then they will be held back. How do you feel about that element of the law?
Well, how I feel is really immaterial. There's research on both sides. It is the law. And what I like about the program is you start early and you start involving the parent early and letting the parent and the student know that, you know, there are some issues here. You have not made benchmark. You are at risk or you're substantially deficient. And we do that through letters and we do it with the teacher doing weekly monitoring. So those are all good things leading up to the summer program. We're all trying to find out, you know, what the rules are and how they will apply. I think that what it's going to end up looking like is that there are waivers, there are ways that you can get to the success without necessarily going to summer school. But if you go to summer school, the idea is you've got to participate. So now the law is passed, I will certainly follow it. And again, it's a whole process and not just, oh, we're in the third grade, we look at the score at the end of the year, and if you didn't pass, you're going to summer school. It really is a process that takes, and now, you know, we're all backing up. We're going, this starts in kindergarten and first grade and second grade. So we all understand that if we can't pass the reading proficiency test by the end of the third grade, then you're going to need to go to summer school because you need extra reading time. And we do know that time on task helps with reading proficiency.
Now, it continues, though, past third grade. And let's say my student doesn't meet reading proficiency standards by the end of third grade. They go to summer school. They participate in summer school. But in fourth grade, they don't meet reading proficiency standards. What happens then?
Well, every school, and I know all districts are doing this, we have what's called a multi-tiered system of support where we know where the students are in their proficiency, whether it's reading or math, and the school day is built around supporting that particular student. I mean, in our elementary schools, we have what's called walk to read, and there's a certain period of every day where there are interventions and everything stops. This is our reading period, and students go and move down the hallway to classes based on their proficiency in reading. So it doesn't stop in the third grade. It goes up fourth and fifth grade, and then in the intermediate school and even in high school now, we have interventions for those students who can't read. The hope is that in years after we put this into place so that by the end of elementary school, everybody is reading at a proficiency level where they can perform in the academics, then we're not going to have the issues that we currently do in intermediate and high schools where there are students who can't read at a proficient level.
How do you deal with the question of holding children back, or retention, as the term is being used, mm-hmm. in Davenport now?
That's done one-on-one. It's done with the parents and the principal, and it's done very rarely.
Do you think that this law will make it more common in Davenport?
Okay. Certainly. I mean, it's got to. There are some people who may not qualify for waiver and may just decide they're not going to send their child to summer school, and then we have to just respond to that. Again, we don't know what all the rules are, and I start thinking about, I mean, there's a lot of reasons in the summer a student couldn't go. What happens if they have, you know, moved during the summer from and their family is just in a distraught state, and they can't put it all together and get to summer school. It's just so many things can happen, and we're just going to have to wait and see what the rules are and, more importantly, how they're applied with the state. And Dr. Wise mentioned flexibility and waivers, and we have to see what that means.
Now, you also said there's research on both sides. There's a lot of research that says that you have short-term academic grades when a child is, or academic improvement when a child is held back. But in the long term, you see that child sort of evening out or even regressing. Mm-hmm. And there are also statistics that show that those kids are more likely to drop out of school before they graduate from high school. We have this note from Rick in Davenport. He said, "I was held back in third grade. We moved three times that school year. You never live it down. Other students won't let you forget it. I would never let one of my kids be held back. You have no idea what effect this has on your life." And clearly a really concerning
absolutely
reaction. So as you move forward, what are your greatest concerns about this?
Well, one of them is something you brought up, finances, in that how are we going to pay for this? And again, I hear that, okay, the state is. I sometimes wonder, and so I'm worried about that. And I'm worried about just what you pointed out, the effect on students and families. And so, one, we have to work very, very hard so that no one is held back. That has got to be the objective of everybody. And the objective should be, by the end of third grade, 100% proficiency. Right now, that's going to be very hard. And the next thing is, okay, well, let's try to get everybody to summer school or perhaps qualify for a waiver, or we'll qualify for one of the flexibilities which is given us. I mean, my hope would be zero people would be held back, but we'll have to wait and see. I mean, we're in the experimental summer school this year, and it'll be interesting to see how things go and what the course looks like and what sort of participation that we get.
Superintendent Tate, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Arthur Tate is the Davenport Superintendent of Schools. We're talking about reading education this hour, and with me now is Donald Baer, professor of education at Iowa State University, and he specializes in research that relates to reading and reading development. Hello, Donald.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And let's get back to some basics. We also want to invite people to join in this conversation with at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And, you know, we're focusing a lot on reading proficiency by the end of third grade. As children develop as readers, can you walk us through some of the milestones of learning to read and the age range that children fall into for those?
Yes, yes, I can. So we start with reading to the child in utero. We want to start at the very beginning. We know we can predict the child's achievement by how many books are in the home. So we want parents to we have a program here in Ames called Raising Readers. So we start in utero. We have pediatricians giving books to families, and so we want that early on. And you see more and more preschool programs attending to literacy. What we're looking for is alphabetic knowledge, singing the alphabet song, phonemic awareness, being aware of sounds. But also we're looking at four-year-olds, their appreciation of nursery rhymes and their appreciation of the rhythm of language and enjoying talking about books and looking at books. And then by 5 years of age, we look for, again, and the alphabet knowledge. They're going to start with their uppercase letters first. But we also look at their ability to memorize text and then see the children pointing. Parents see their child on the floor pretend reading and pointing left to right. That's called directionality. And so we're teaching parents how to read to their children in preschool. But come kindergarten, we see the children pointing accurately as they read. And once they can point accurately to what they've memorized, then they begin to collect a sight vocabulary, and then they begin to write a little bit as well. And so by first grade, they're learning sight words, they're pointing to the words as they read. So they've moved from emergent readers to the second stage, which we call beginning reading. And so they point to the words as they read. They read out loud when they read to themselves. They're monotonic, disfluent, and they read about 60 words per minute. And then we see the children moving, we'd like to see this in first grade, to the transitional stage of reading. And that's when they're, and this is an exciting time because it begins when they're reading Nate the Great, Dinosaur Days, and they're mixing reading orally and silently. They begin to pick up some fluency.
And we're going to have to take a short break, and we'll be back, and we'll dip right back into that transitional stage of reading. We're talking about reading education this hour, and with me, Donald Baer, a professor of education at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. This is Talk of Iowa.
When I look back through life, I find lots of memories remain. Certain days stay in my mind and keep running through my brain. I remember the day that Edley swam the channel, what a splash! I remember the Wall Street crash, or when Winslow first shouted flash. But there's one day that I recall, though it was years ago. All my life I will remember it, I know. I'll never forget the day I read a book. It was contagious, 70 pages.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about reading education, and right now we're focusing on what we know about how children learn to read. With me is Donald Baer, a professor of education at Iowa State University. And Donald, just before the break, we were talking about the different stages that kids go through as they learn to read, and you were talking about the transitional stage. So I'll let you pick up your thread there.
Thank you. The transitional stage is so important because it signifies the move from oral reading to silent reading, from very easy books like Nate the Great all the way to Junie B. Jones, easy chapter books, Horrible Harry. And this stage is very interesting given your previous discussion because this is, our students and I call it, my students call it the black hole of reading. We have kids who have learned their short vowels, and then they get stuck on long vowels, and they never seem to climb out and pick up this reading fluency where they're reading over 100 words per minute. And so this is an important period. And we're looking now, with the core standards, we're looking for transitional readers in first grade. But you'll see transitional readers up until up through third grade at least.
Well, that was going to be my next question. So you've outlined a timeline for kids, but of course, some kids learn to read very early, some kids learn to read later. There's a pretty wide range of normal, isn't there?
There is, and 4% of children learn without any instruction at all. But we can define over the grade levels approximately where we expect children to read, and that's what the FAST is doing. It's identifying very early in this kindergarten where the children are and what we need to pay attention to, children who are significantly behind. There is that range. You'll talk to fathers of children who are behind, and they say, oh, yes, my mom said that it was third grade before I picked up. And so you do want to look at family history. More importantly, you want to look at language development, early language development. So many of the children who have difficulties with language are delayed in their literacy development as well. But we can have ranges by grade level and expect children to be in those ranges and identify kids who are significantly behind.
Now, I have read some parenting articles on the subject of reading that say you don't want to push your child to read if they're not indicating an interest or they may be meeting a lot of the milestones of readiness, but if they don't want to do it, you may be creating problems if you are pushing it. What do you think about that?
The push is on. We have to find a way to get them interested in literacy, to read to them, to make it fun. So we need all of the affective stuff, if you will. But we... we also need to be explicit and direct in our instruction and meet the child where he or she is. That is, we have to teach them developmentally. And so what I find often is that the children who are resisting reading are often being taught at their frustration level. And at the university, we teach these stages so that teachers can eyeball and earball children's oral reading.
And what does that mean, their frustration level?
If you're missing a lot of words when you read, for example, when we read as adults, we're reading with 99% accuracy, and we're reading about 250 words per minute. But if you're a fifth grader and you're reading with 90% accuracy or worse, then you are going to not be able to comprehend very easily, missing 1 in 10 or more than 1 in 10 words as you read. Try to read at less than 100 words per minute. It's hard to hold the language together as you read. So if you're a sixth grader and you're reading at a third grade level, you're not going to be very interested in literacy. So that frustration, we have three levels: the independent level, where the child is doing very nicely; the instructional level, and that's where we aim our instruction; and that's the tier one that was mentioned earlier. And then we're looking at the frustration level, and those are children who are in this tier two and tier three, the way we often define it, who needs that extra support.
Now, you mentioned that the push is on, and it is for a lot of parents, for a lot of kids. With their, and you also mentioned that, you know, literacy begins at birth with parents reading to their children. Now, some parents want to push a little bit harder, and there are lots and lots of products geared toward those parents, like the My Baby Can Read program, or even the kinds of interactive technology where a word lights up on a tablet while it's being read, or those kinds of things. What do we know about the efficacy of those tools in helping children learn to read?
They don't replace reading to your child. They don't replace having that child on your lap and enjoying reading books together. And there's not, we don't want to hurry it, and we don't want to get too skill-oriented. We want it to be a holistic event, if you will. Certainly sing the alphabet song, certainly point out text and show the left to right, and talk about the characteristics of print. All of that is good stuff, but don't get foot-tootsed or uptight about how many sight words does your child know. We're looking for the child to be interested in literacy. We're looking for those early behaviors of being able to point accurately. And then come first grade, we're looking for that love of reading at home, to the recreational reading. And then we're also looking for parents to talk to their teachers. Is my child significantly behind? And if the child is behind, then we need to intervene and intervene early.
Now, we mentioned during that transitional stage or that level of frustration, the importance of reading comprehension. We've been talking this hour about a lot of the different assessments that are used for testing reading proficiency, and I'm not hearing comprehension as a part of some of those tests.
Oh, good. That's a good point. It is there in our teaching. We do emphasize comprehension a great deal. In the FAST, it's a splendid measure, stronger than most that we've used, and it is also adaptive so that you can save time. It sort of moves up and down as the child performs, so it's a little briefer. But comprehension is hard to measure. So a lot of the FAST is measuring the phonological knowledge, the phonics, the fluency, and a little bit of the vocabulary that the child has. So comprehension is something that the teacher is monitoring, but it doesn't make for a very good standardized measure.
There are a lot of different, we've been talking about FAST, but there are a lot of different assessment tools that teachers can use, and different ones are used in different states and different districts. Do we have too many assessments?
Many would argue, and probably I'm in this, that yes, we do have too many. We need to narrow down the number of tests. We need to narrow down the hours and dollars that we're spending on the test prep. I'm in teacher ed, so my desire is to work on getting that teacher to identify the child and to be knowledgeable about literacy development and literacy interventions and when to give support support and what types of materials to use.
Now, we had an email earlier from a listener who said, I went to a country school. Our teacher didn't even have a license, but we all learned how to read. Are things changing? Do we have a lower level of reading proficiency in Iowa today than we did years ago? Is this something that we're seeing nationwide?
The reason it's a lower – there are a couple of reasons why there's a lower proficiency. One is that the stakes are higher than they've ever been. You have to read better today than ever before. So I'd have to take that person that person's case individually. But today the kindergartners need to know something about short vowels. They need to have a fairly substantial sight vocabulary at the end of first grade, much greater than we did 10 years ago. So the standards are stronger than ever before. We are teaching better than ever before as well, but the bar has been raised. And that's a major factor for us.
I'm talking with Donald Baer, professor of education at Iowa State University. We're talking about reading education this hour. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Rissa is on the line in Waterloo. Hi, Rissa.
Hi.
Hi. What are your concerns?
Well, my concern, from my understanding, was speaking with my daughter's principal, that there are no accommodations for special needs children. I have a daughter who's in first grade who has ADHD and anxiety, and, you know, she had all the literacy stuff as a toddler and an infant. We have tons of books, but she has ADHD and anxiety. She has an IEP, so she has she is allowed accommodations for standardized testing, but for the third grade testing, that will not be allowed. So my concern for my child and all of the special needs children is, are we going to have a group of kids who are not going to be able to pass this test because they have whatever special need they have and are not allowed the accommodations, and even in some cases then can't go to summer school for whatever reason that is. And so are we going to have a group of special needs kids who are being held back because of something that's not really even their fault and who are learning, it's just not as fast or as quickly as the state wants them to?
Rissa, thanks a lot for your call. And reading the information about the law, I have read that children with an IEP, an individualized education program, will not be held to the same standards. But Donald, do you have information on that? Can you respond to that?
They should be given accommodations, and I would check with their school district, the principal, to see. Same with English learners, as noted earlier.
So, but Rissa has a very real concern for a lot of parents. Even if their child doesn't have an IEP, there are kids who have difficulty in learning to read that maybe hasn't been documented or diagnosed. Is that a real concern for you?
It is a concern. We have a low percentage of children who are going to need accommodations later on, for example. And this is there are federal laws that even at the university for children who are not good readers who get the support that they need. We call that success in school, having books read to them, et cetera. So we do need to be mindful of students with special needs and make sure that they are being stimulated academically, and we can work around literacy. And at the same time, we have to offer remediation to these children. Nearly all people can learn to read well, and we're looking at a very small percentage of children. If we provide early and sufficient instruction, nearly all children can learn to read well. So I'd like to look at that child and make sure that he or she is getting the instruction.
Do you feel like, for example, dyslexia is being diagnosed as often as it's present? I've heard from people in the past who, you know, discover that they're dyslexic as an adult. They struggled all the way through school and no one gave them a hand. Nobody helped them.
Yes. And I think the word is struggle. I'm going to be respectful of anybody who's experienced difficulty. The why of it is important to understand as well. So we have percentages of some people say only 3% are dyslexic, all the way to 20% saying that we have 20% of our students are dyslexic. Those higher numbers are usually including children who have language difficulties as well, and that's a very high number. So that's why I'm fairly comfortable saying that that's why we're looking so carefully at professional development for teachers, as well as good programs for kids and enough time kids having being in programs long enough to make that substantial growth. We know that if you're in a tutoring program, that if you're in a tutoring program for 23 hours, that will impact your growth over time. We also know that if you're in third grade and you're significantly behind, that 80% of the kids by the end of sixth grade don't catch up. So this is quite a problem, and that's why we want to start early.
Jake is on the line from Olwine. Hi, Jake.
Hello. Good morning.
And we heard from someone earlier who'd been held back and was not happy about it. You have a different experience. Tell us about your experience.
Well, back in those days, it was called I flunked. I flunked third grade. I was not retained, and you know that certainly has a stigma with it also. But to me, it was the best thing that ever happened. I mean, I found my third grade teacher, and this is back in the 50s. I'm 68 years old. This is back in the 50s. And I found my third grade teacher a couple years ago, and I wrote her a letter thanking her for holding me back, and it was wonderful. And, you know, it was embarrassing and humiliating at the time, but I outgrew it. And today, you know, I laugh it off and say, you know, third grade is my two favorite years in school.
Well, Jake, thank you so much for sharing that experience with us. And we were talking about retention or holding children back earlier. Donald, is that an effective tool in helping them learn to read?
I would say that we have to be very careful about it. Is the general answer. The earlier, the better. In the Reading Center, the Duffelmeyer Center, I talk to families, and we I'm more interested in kindergarten and first grade for young kids, and I can see that support. The new research, generally the research does not support retention. Some of the new research is interesting because they're looking at where do we place the child in that retention year, and that seems to make a little bit of a difference.
Right. And I want to get Esther on the line before we run out of time. Esther in Donaldson. Hi, Esther.
Hi.
Hi, and you're a kindergarten teacher?
Yes, I happen to have the day off because we had parent-teacher conferences two nights this week, so it's my comp day, and I'm pleased that I could hear your program. I just wanted to chip in on the pressure that the teachers in our district are under to get our children at the benchmark level on these FAST tests, and I know the superintendent you had on talked about having people come in to do the assessments for the teachers. Well, we don't have that in our district. So in kindergarten, it takes at least 10 minutes each child to sit one-on-one and do the assessments three times a year. And we have to keep, I have 18 in my class now, I have to keep the other 17 children occupied, which is no easy trick in kindergarten. So there's that. Then we have to do progress monitoring once a week, and I'm doing that on half of my children. As well as interventions. And my concern is not only the time that it takes to do all of this that takes us away from the other children, but that the children that are at high levels are being left out. I have probably five kids reading at second grade level or higher, but I cannot find time in the day to meet their needs, and they are going to be the leaders in our world, and I feel like they are ignored through this whole process. So that's my great concern.
Oh, and Esther, thank you so much for sharing that with us today. And we're nearly out of time. But Donald, I want to give you just a moment to respond to Esther. I know a lot of teachers are frustrated.
Yes, and I can appreciate it. And the core standards do point out the need to address the needs of the high-achieving children. So we do need more support. We need to cut back on some of the testing that we're doing. We need to teach in small groups and not just in whole class. And I appreciate what this teacher has said. She is swamped.
Well, Donald, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Donald Baer, professor of education at Iowa State University. We've been talking about reading education this hour on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. 2, 8, 4, 9, 9, 9. I'm gonna teach you.